Welcome to the IoT 613 podcast, featuring the people, products, and companies that are helping to build our connected world. My name is Robert Decker, and I'm pleased to be your host for this podcast series. On today's episode, we speak with well-known Canadian technology and business leader, Leo Lax, who's currently spearheading LSpark, a business and technology accelerator in Kanata, Ontario, with a national and global reach. LSpark has accelerated more than 50 companies to date, and has raised $45 million by the portfolio, and now offers three different accelerator programs. While SaaS remains a large focus for LSpark, their latest programs are vehicles for technological innovation for autonomous vehicles, healthcare, rail, and secure IoT, among others. Of course, we're honored to have Leo Lax on our podcast, so let's jump right in. Hi, Leo. A pleasure to speak with you today. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing? It's summertime in Ottawa. It's pretty hot these days.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think I got a chance to do some interesting stuff with my grandchildren at the cottage, and I'm now back to work.
Isn't that what it's all about, right? Family and grandkids. That's
right.
Amazing.
Getting a balanced life is important.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about your life. You know, I want to know a bit about your background. Where are you from and what did you study?
I've graduated from McGill University with an electrical engineering degree. Right out of university, I was part of a military program called the ROTP at the time, and I became a signal officer, and I spent 10 years in the Army, which I enjoyed, and I must say it was one of the best training capabilities that I've ever received in staff duties, leadership. Even though some people will say it is constraining and it's difficult to live. But when over that process, I also ended up applying for my master's degree. I received my master's while I was at Royal Military College in Kingston. And then a few years later, I left the Army and started a company, became part of a team that started a company called Norpac out of Pakenham. That company did not fare so well. When the company was wound up, I ended up working for Terry Matthews at MITA. And we've been together working on and off over the past many years. And that's kind of how I got to here.
It's a big jump going from engineering, military, sort of venture capitalism, accelerator, and we'll kind of dig into all of that. I'm really interested. I want to go back to the military because that's, you know, 10 years plus the university. RMC is a very disciplined education. I remember looking into it when I was young, thinking, okay, I can do a four-year program, and I think you have to do 4 or 5 years after the fact, which is great, a guaranteed job. I did spend a couple of years in the Navy Reserve, so I understand the lessons in leadership and teamwork and work ethic. Can you talk a little bit more about the military experience?
Well, so I think the military experience provided a number of things. One of them was an ability to understand what it is to push to your infinite capacity. Most of us actually have more capacity than we believe. And the military exercises that process in learning at what point you will actually break. That's a good point to understand because it would actually provide huge benefit when you're an entrepreneur, where you realize that an imminent disaster that just reaches just outside your vision, that's coming at you really fast, may not be the ultimate end of your whatever. And in fact, you will wake up the next morning enthusiastic again and ready to go and see whether you can overcome that problem. That idea of overcoming obstacles is something that is inbred in the military training. Mm-hmm. It is constraining. It is definitely structured. And structure is also good. Structure provides means for understanding how to build comfort, for instance. Knowing that which your limits are and boundaries are all interesting, part of that structural arrangement. For entrepreneurs, where they are interested in reaching out and building their dreams, structure provides the means for defining their goals for identifying the steps necessary to meet those goals. And if those goals are not being met, to determine what needs to be corrected in order that goals could become more achievable. So I think those are all good lessons that are part of what somebody can take away from military career. But of course, it's not for everybody. And that's part of the other part. There is no kind of a one way of doing things that fits all.
Yeah. Do you ever think where your life would be if you did not enter the military?
Not really. I think I am more interested in looking forward than looking back.
Well, I'm going to force you to look back a little bit here because I love the context of where you're at today and your experience throughout your various careers. So electrical engineering.
Yes.
What does that mean to you and what did you learn from that early experience?
So I probably do very little electrical engineering and probably have done very little electrical engineering in my overall career. As a very detailed research and development style engineering activity, but it provided me with a background to understand what it is to work in software. And my master's was in the software communication engineering. So it provided all of the tools that I think allowed me in later in life to communicate with engineers, lead them in some cases, help them understand. In many cases, I found that one of the benefits, if you will, of being in front of a number of people and having both a background in engineering as well as a general experience in activities and business is to translate the complexities that are coming in the engineering environment in a way in which non-technical people want to relate to it.
I can appreciate that a lot. In various careers of mine, I've had leaders that don't quite understand the sort of technical bits of the mandate and others that really understand the technical side. So kudos to you. You mentioned telecommunications, your early career. You spent some time with Mitel
and Newbridge.
Yeah. I think that was probably a good decade or so, right?
Man,
telecommunication.
More than one decade.
And that's Ottawa, right? That was the heyday of yes. Ottawa telecommunications. Can you tell me a bit about what you learned during this period of time?
So I think that's great to relate back to where we were. The world was just moving from I would call it an analog world, technically speaking, into mm-hmm. a digital world. There was a huge transformation in the communications area. That transformation led for the opening of the use of communications in very broader range than before. Up to that, if you feel kind of in the 60s and so earlier, communication was primarily voice communication on telephones. That's really what, or radio communications, but mostly it was all voice. There was very little other than voice communication, with the exception of the telegraph, which was also voice related, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, imagine what digital transformation has done to the market. It has now allowed that same communication capability to allow machines to talk to other machines, to allow people to talk to machines in some variety of ways, and that created a whole transformation. And Mitel and Newbridge were kind of in the forefront of that type of transformation. Mitel was one of the early companies that introduced the voice and data capabilities in the PBX, in the telephone system. In some cases, it was so early that it was actually unheard of, and it was very difficult to convince anybody that was of any use. Today, we just take it for granted. Newbridge was in the same forefront on the other side. It transformed the broader communication environment, which was the networks associated with the communications, to be much more efficient, much more enabled, and much more available to a broader range of people. So what you had, if you think about it in many ways, all the way to way, way back, probably in the 1910, 15, if you wanted to use a phone, you had to go to a location, to a telephone company location, that they had a booth.
Yeah.
Where you were put into that booth and some operator would ring another booth somewhere else and the two operators would figure out what to do, and then you would be able to pick up the phone and from your booth talk to that booth, which was, so communication at that time was very much point to point, from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
We grew from there to be a network, so we had multiple points, but still very static. Today, communication is everywhere, connected all the time. It is location independent, and all of that transformation was part of what fueled Mitel and Newbridge to its successes. And I was lucky enough to be part of that and to have teams working around us, Terry Matthews working with us, leading all of these capabilities, taking the risk associated with charging ahead, even when the path was not clearly defined, convincing customers to try things that they originally were not quite sure are going to work. And then lo and behold, because we had amazing engineers in all of these cases, we made it work. All of that was very exciting. And I think we still do. I think Ottawa still has all of that energy, except we have yet to kind of bring it again together into a unified core to actually allow us to become preeminent again, hopefully.
There's a lot that I could dig into there. You know, part of my thinking is, you know, how has that shaped the Ottawa market? I think we've covered that and we'll trickle into that throughout our conversation. Some of it is the concept of there's a lot happening in Ottawa still, sort of fragmented. How do we bring that closer together again?
Well, it's hard to do, I think, because our current environment is exactly very distributed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't physically need to be in any one place to actually make things happen. We have the tools and capabilities to work in a distributed fashion. And that, on one side, provides huge amounts of opportunity, but it also makes that collaboration process that builds momentum much more difficult. And so in Ottawa, we do have areas of interest that are somewhat disjointed and separate. I think all of us who are in this business right now, like you, like myself, like many others that we know, are working hard to break down those barriers and work together to build an overall community that can actually improve our life and become more prominent. And I would say it's still a work in progress.
There's a lot happening in Ottawa. We've got some major corporations here. We've got some, you know, accelerators like LSPARC and a lot of support systems in place for corporate and entrepreneurship. And there is a very complex ecosystem here. You know, I've heard it said that Ottawa is the Canada's capital of SaaS, and we're here at LSPARC in Ottawa. Why would you classify Ottawa as the capital of software as a service?
So, you know, software as a service is really a business model. It's a way of offering software to the users, to the community. It's a business model. It's also enabled through a broad range of technologies that have come about, allowing that model to exist. The Ottawa groups, the companies that were in the past, the leaders in Ottawa, the Nortels, the Mitels, the Newbridges, the JDSs, on and on and on, smaller companies, Medium, Gandalf, and so on. There were a wide range of companies, and the ones that are currently in place have all been working in this environment and have had employees who learned and experienced the new and capable and decided and designed new things related to this software as a service capability. Whether it was enabling clouds, meaning the technical clouds, whether it was the ability to deliver services through digital media, all of these technologies were actually technologies that were developed and implemented, software that was written and designed by people who were in Ottawa in those stages. Even though the companies themselves have morphed into a variety of other companies, the people themselves remain here in Ottawa. They still live here. Yeah. They chose not to do anything other than continue living here. And that's why we have a very rich set of people that are experienced, have deep knowledge, have enormous market access, had the Rolodex is worldwide as a result of where they were when they were part of the heyday of the amazing stuff in Ottawa. And I think that is what we want to allow new entrepreneurs to engage with. It is challenging because there is the old guard and the new guard concept. You know, mm-hmm. we know better, new guard guys will tell me, you know, you guys no longer understand, we have new tools, new ways of doing it. And the fact is that that's partially true. However, in my view, the really smart and energetic and knowledgeable entrepreneurs will say, yes, I know how to use this set of new things that have come around. Wouldn't it be amazing if I was able to get the lessons learned that the old guard already had and figured out, the scars that you have on your backs as a result of experiments that have failed and now could be, and take that lessons learned, inject it into the technology and leverage that to actually create the next best things.
It sounds like we're talking about LSPARC here, so let's continue that. Why don't we start with a brief description of what is LSPARC?
So LSPARC is an accelerator. Its mission is to create the capability in companies that are mentored by us, that are come to us, that are accepted and selected by us to become the next billion-dollar companies in Canada. It is our mission that over the state of our existence, we should be able to get 2 to 3 billion-dollar companies emerging from that environment. Now, we know that the likelihood of going from an early stage startup or even to a billion-dollar company is 1 in a million style of success. However, we think that by creating that lessons learned injection of experience, we can improve the odds. And therefore, maybe we can get to 1 or 2 in 100. Mm-hmm. And so, if we continue doing it, then we will have mentored and worked with 100 companies. I'm hoping 5 or 6 of these companies will be in the multiple hundreds of millions. 1 or 2 may actually make it to the billions. And that will be great for all of us if that happens.
And we've been operating this since, I think, 2014. Your first cohort was 2015.
That's correct.
And so there's a lot of case studies we could dig into. I should note that there are 3 accelerator programs. The original is the LSPARC accelerator,
yeah.
Right? And then you have a second, which is in partnership with BlackBerry QNX.
Yeah.
And then there's a third, which is relatively new, is your IoT accelerator.
Correct. So, and they're really very different. And let me give you kind of a high-level oversight.
Please.
The SaaS accelerator is a business accelerator. Its main objective is to change the trajectory of businesses that have selected to join us and work with us from being growing companies to being exceptionally growing companies. Creating that change will require injection of know-how, which is done through our mentors, and access to a wide range of networks, business networks, investor networks, teams, talent networks, and so on, which LSPARC has built around its ecosystem right now. And at the same time, building a comfort level for the entrepreneurs to take those enormous risks that they need to do in order to change the trajectory of their company from a moderately growing entity to being an exceptionally growing entity. So that's our business accelerator. Our other 2 accelerators are corporate accelerators, and they are really have a different objective. They are much more custom to the corporations that are involved. In the BlackBerry QNX accelerator, we have approached them and said, describe to us the areas in your ecosystem that you'd like to expand and improve on. So it is not a general business accelerator. It is an accelerator that is designed and specifically put in place to meet a corporate objective of the corporate partner. So it's a much more narrowly defined, and it's usually technology and product oriented rather than business oriented.
Yeah. So it's more about the project itself, the talent required to build the technologies as a sort of R&D arm, innovation arm.
Correct. And we think about this way. Large companies have a number of things that are amazing for them. They have reach. They are global. They have great amount of technology that is built into products that lots and lots of people are using. These products are, in a sense, platforms. And in today's world, many of these products have built-in interfaces, both technical and business interfaces, to allow others to customize those products even more, or improve those products, or enhance those products using other relationships with them. So large companies all build these types of products. The technical terms are building APIs that allow people to interact technically, and then building relationships to expand that in some ecosystem. The challenge is that large companies need large partners, because small partners just don't move the dial enough.
Mm-hmm.
So they are busy doing the large partner-to-partner relationships and making sure that all of that works, and that's their main business. What they lack, and they would like to have, but they cannot actually be able to address because don't have time on the day or whatever, is access to the innovation economy that may, in fact, become an enormous beneficial partner in the future, but in the initial innovation is too low an interest level, maybe something that's too marginal and therefore not core enough. And so how do they do that? So in many cases, they just ignore it, and when something happens, happens.
Mm-hmm.
We are offering them an opportunity to build that ecosystem with a limited amount of interface into their own environment, with a limited amount of interference into their own business, because we act as that low friction interface between the small, agile, and innovative company that is trying to build the next big thing and the major global entity that is reaching out to the entire world and has lots and lots of capabilities and people and technology, but is unable to actually pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Or in most cases, if they do, their attention is so invasive that it kills the early stage company. So we make sure that we have that, on one side, protective barrier for the early stage companies to continue grow under that engagement, and on the other side, build that interface to the corporate side. So we have two corporate accelerators. One, built around the BlackBerry QNX platform, which is an amazing real-time operating system, probably the best in the world, that is being used by over 75% of the automotive industry today. There are tons of ideas and applications that can be built on top of that platform. They are only addressing those that our major customers currently are interested in, because that's what the business is.
Yeah, you have to feed the pipeline.
And that works, and that's necessary, and it's the business of their business. So they should not be distracted and worry about the $500,000 a year company that's got four engineers, but doing this amazing thing that would be really interesting if it could be amplified through the reach of the corporate. So we are acting as that interface on this case. We are also looking for not just any corporate entity, but also a corporate entity that's building a platform that's easily accessible. Because we are not only about the relationship, but we are also about the acceleration. So in a QNX, BlackBerry QNX accelerator, seven companies were selected to participate, and all were able to develop custom applications on top of the RTOS, real-time operating system of QNX, that were real demonstrable implementation to achieve the same connection, support, and delivery of a real implemented product, prototype, early stage product, in 6 months would be totally out of the thinking process of anybody. So that's what we are bringing. We are bringing that acceleration, we are that compression of time to to allow the early stage companies to do what would take multiple years to do if they try to on their own to connect to the BlackBerry QNX system, figure out how they interface, figure out what they need to do, get the technical, answer all of the questions. All of that is being husbanded through our interface.
So to dig in on that, you have seven companies brought in for the BlackBerry QNX. They've prototyped and created a product essentially that can integrate into their operating.
Yeah. Seven products.
And so where does that go after? You hand over the keys? Do you continue to build it out with your corporate partners?
So the seven companies are part of our alumni, and therefore they continue engaging with us. But it is a... So while they're engaging with us, we are intensely connected. We do our intense customized correction. These ones need R&D support. These ones need marketing support. These guys need talent. These need product definition. We do all that, and our mentors are the ones who customize that relationship. That's kind of where the seven have kind of got into this process. What happens next is totally up to them and BlackBerry, with our oversight, where we have access and facilitate that next stage. In this particular case, I believe, and I'm maybe speaking on behalf of the BlackBerry team, and they may be thinking differently, probably two or three of these seven companies will actually get to a more wholesome engagement that will lead to something. The rest are not. Now, some of it could be because they are doing an application that is interesting, but really not that interesting for QNX. In some cases, the company was interested, but now found that, that was interesting, but the business is really somewhere else.
Yeah.
So the way you look at it is the company, it is, we switch from being engaged to offering a buffet. Okay, Mr. Company 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, what would you like to do? If you'd like us to help you engage with BlackBerry QNX, tell us. Mm-hmm. You reach out to us, and we'll make it happen. So it's up to them to figure out if they need help or not after they've left. So that's our alumni.
So possible outcomes could be acquisition.
Yeah.
Hiring.
Yeah. Business relationships, offering the products to their customers.
Yeah, supplier relationship.
Or in some cases, and I think that's probably one of the more immediate benefits, increasing the credibility of the early stage companies, because they are not just any company. They are a company that has been selected by BlackBerry QNX to be part of their accelerator. So they are gaining credibility from that selection process by itself.
So this accelerator we're talking about covers autonomous vehicles.
Correct.
There's the third accelerator, the secure IoT accelerator, which is also with BlackBerry, but I believe other partners include TELUS and Solus.
Yes.
Probably some others there. So secure IoT, that's your newer accelerator.
That's right. We just launched it, and that's, again, a product-oriented accelerator. It is a R&D-style accelerator. The four companies that have been selected to join the accelerators are building products that are based on a platform that the accelerator is made available for them at no cost to them. So that's... And let's go a little bit on what the acceleration is going to do. Most of the companies, all four companies, already have some element of product, some capabilities, some engagement with the market.
So how far along are the companies then, do you mean?
They range anywhere from very, very early stage to quite established. And in the case of where they are established, it is taking their non-connected IoT product and transforming it into a connected IoT product that has a built-in security. So here is the one way of looking at what we're doing. IoT products are Internet of Things. So it ranges from wearables to sensors to deep technology capabilities to allow cars to be manipulated, managed, and organized, and so on, or a whole bunch of range of things.
Mm-hmm.
The many of our existing IoT products in the past were standalone products. They could be not consumer focused. They could be business focused,
right?
Because they would be managing the maintenance cycle for a particular factory.
Yeah.
But they were what I would call closed circuit. The computer system, the sensoring activity, the analysis and delivery, and closed control loops mm-hmm. were all done very close to each other.
Yeah.
What our current technology has allowed, due to all of the things we know is happening, is we can now have those IoT products that were localized to be connected and to be globalized and to be made available anywhere, at any time, at any place, and still be able to manage provision in some well-defined way. That connectivity demands security.
Of course.
By definition. And today, we are in the early stage of getting the connectivity working, and we are even in a much earlier stage in building the infrastructure necessary to make that connectivity happen in a secure, reliable, and scalable way. And that is the platform that the Secure IoT Accelerator is offering to our selected companies.
There's a lot happening on the security front, and perhaps it is distributed among many different companies doing a sort of narrowly tasked security application for a specific product or industry. So how does this accelerator bridge that gap to be more of a universal security, right?
So we are focusing on one element of the Secure IoT business. We want to ensure that the provisioning and management and operation of the IoT device in a connected environment is done securely, but even more importantly, it's done under the control and management of the owner of the IoT device. Whether that's a company or whether that's an individual, you want to be responsible, you, the company or the individual, responsible on how that IoT device is being updated, is being managed, how the data that the IoT device is generating is being accessed, who's accessing it, when are they accessing it, all of that. Wouldn't it be great if it was under the control of the person who owns that IoT device or the company that's managing that IoT network? Those are, you know, Ford is going to have millions of automobiles running around. Each one of them will have 10 to 15 IoT devices connected to each other and connected to some other cars potentially, and maybe even connected to some other facilities to allow to improve the usage of that vehicle. We want to make sure two things. We want to make sure that that's done in a safe and secure way. We want to make sure that if updates are required, they're done in a predictable way and they are under the control of the owner of the car, ideally. And if I chose to have my maintenance done by Canadian Tire instead of Ford, because I have a Ford car, I should have the ability to do that. Today, under the current IoT environment, and this is not happening in that environment, I'm just giving you an example.
Yeah.
It would be the car manufacturer who would say, all of it is connected to me, you are part of my world, and I'm offering you the full service required. And I, as a purchaser of that particular IoT system, have only one choice.
Yeah.
I have to choose the entire environment as well as the IoT device. Wouldn't it be amazing if I had the freedom to choose my service? Whether I get that service from TELUS, or from Bell, or from Vodafone, or from China Telecom, would be up to me, mm-hmm. rather than the manufacturer of the IoT device who has had, by necessity, in order to secure its device, a prearranged relationship with some of the service providers. That platform is difficult to implement. It requires significant amount of interaction between different types of companies. The Secure IoT Accelerator was founded by three companies. TELUS, who's providing the technology and know-how for amazing connectivity capabilities in the IoT space. BlackBerry, who is a preeminent secure OS supplier and therefore can ensure that the operating system that is running these IoT devices is not only secure, but it's managed, updated in a secure fashion. And then lastly, to enable all of that to work, you need to be able to talk to different type of service providers. You have to negotiate an arrangement that allows those different organizations to agree with you that you will be the owner of the key that you can hand over to the cloud provider so that they can access my device, can hand over to the service provider carrier to allow connectivity happen in a secure way, or to the application provider to ensure that that application can actually take the data or use the data in their own way. That key management process is part of what Sonos is providing. They are a messaging system that rides on top of this platform and enables the communication, messaging communication, to manage and organize all of that. We have been fortunate, maybe lucky, maybe amazingly strategic thinking, probably a combination, to have had these three companies agree to work together and build an integrated stack that allows these three separate capabilities to talk to each other so that an IoT service manufacturer does not need to worry about the whole stack. They get an API and they implement it. They say, hi, give me the key, verify the key is good, have the key handed to so-and-so for 10 minutes, take the key back and stop them from using it, and it's all done through that simple way without having to know and understand all the underlying complexity. The R&D teams from these three companies worked over 4 months to build that stack. We put it on together into a development kit that is built on a very open platform called the Raspberry Pi. Mm-hmm. We're using Linux, secure Linux, through the BlackBerry relationship to allow the developers to actually access all of that stack in a user-friendly way. And the four companies will hopefully demonstrate applications using this entire stack by October this year.
That's a quick turnaround, yeah. I love the concept of finding a mechanic to work on your IoT car. You know, as I go to my mechanic, I can feel their anxiety of how quickly cars are changing and they need to be more electrical and software oriented and, you know, looking into the future of walking into Canadian Tire and having a computer programmer update your car. But one thing you also said is having the car owner, the user, be in control of updates. I'm not sure I like that. I feel as though the car should be on a schedule to update, pushed by the manufacturer, maybe a combination of each. But do I really trust the average Joe to maintain the updates of his iPhone, let alone, you know, a vehicle?
But the whole point is not that you're giving them the ability to control. Mm-hmm. They can say, I want no control. Hey, Mr. Owner of the IoT device, I trust you.
Yeah.
Therefore, carry on. Update it whenever you want because I know you're going to do the right thing in the right place.
Yeah.
But I want to have that option. If I don't want to do that, or if I decide that the service that I'm receiving from Group A is not the service that I want right now and I prefer to get Group B, I want to have the freedom to move my service from Group A to Group B and not be locked in. And our IoT, secure IoT platform that we are verifying and testing right now through the accelerator, we are validating that that is doable. And one of the demonstrations that's gonna be done through this IoT, secure IoT in October, will actually demonstrate the capability, and we are not yet fully fleshed out how, but basically, imagine you are being provided door access security from company A, not into who they are, but it's company A, and now choose that you know what, I no longer want company A to do it because I've moved to another city and the other city has company B doing it. Today, if you bought a door controller, IoT device, you have only one option. It's the one that the IoT device manufacturer has provided you for serving through their cloud, through their implementation, a secure one. It's all good, it's all right, it works well, but it is what they have chosen and decided on, and it's not under me. Mm-hmm. 99% of the people will probably will be good enough. In the same way as we don't need to control all of the intricacies of all of the other things that we have. But having that option is now, I think, creates a differentiator for the market, for those that allow that option to happen, and it allows creating special access to those users that would choose not to use a product because they are so constrained in their implementation. So we have one company, Flosonics, that's in the health tech environment. They are building a sensor that's measuring the blood flow that allows medical practitioners to determine how much IV fluids need to be injected in real-time basis. Today, that's done by a person physically being with the patient and using fairly complex technology to figure out what it is, where it should be, and then controlling how much fluids are going to be delivered into your body.
Yeah.
With the secure IoT platform, we can now offer that service to somebody who's remotely located in a moving vehicle, like an ambulance, connected through this environment and securely to a practitioner who is the doctor in the hospital somewhere, maybe 1,000 miles away, and has the real ability to say, here's what needs to get done, and saving lives. So that's one. We have another application that's in the oil and gas area. One of the elements in the oil and gas area is to identify risks associated with ground failures. Pipelines, earthquake, ground failures, issues, pipelines break. You want to know that's likely to happen before it happens. Today, there is systems in place that will measure this kind of ground movement, weather impacts of all of that, and AI systems that will be able to initially predict, maybe later on, exactly what are the risk elements and how to ideally try to mitigate them before they happen. In most of these cases, that means somebody going in a truck, out to a location, doing things on the ground, and coming back. Imagine the opportunity when you can actually deploy these sensors in some automated fashion, who are connected now through the system, and all of this risk assessment and mitigation can be done through AI systems that are on the cloud, much more robust than what's possible locally in a local environment with very small hardened devices, and can be fed back to a management system. That's another company called Platoy. We have a third company that's called CanScan out of Montreal. Sorry, one of them is out of Sudbury. The health tech company is out of Sudbury. Platoy is out of Vancouver. CanScan is a Montreal-based company that is providing container assessment of how well the containers are and where they are in large ports and terminals. The issue there is that these containers are moving around with cranes, are being located in different places, and in order to improve and optimize the use of the port, there are systems in the back that allow optimizing where these containers should be placed and how they should be moved. All of this is now needs to be inspected manually to see whether this particular movement of this particular container, this actually ended up where it was. And if it isn't, we better get a crane to move it again. Imagine how much more efficient it is if you had a mobile camera environment that was able to, using AI and pattern recognition capabilities, identify the container, identify the location of the container, and then use that online system to allow the management system in the port to figure out how to optimize it in real time without having manual inspections going in. In addition to that, this particular system will also be able to look at container damage, breakages, possible ways in which containers are maybe opened without permission or whatever. These are add-on. So that's the application. And what the IoT Secure Activity is, allows that complex computational task to be done in the cloud in a safe and secure way and on a mobile device. And then the last one is actually an interesting difference. We have been able to recruit a company called CIRA. That's the Canadian Internet Registration Authority. This is the organization in Canada that issues the .ca domain, manages the .ca domain. They are involved because they are one of the key facilitators in allowing the ability to make sure that all of these IoT devices have the security and necessary capability to be used on the Canadian internet in a secure fashion and a capable fashion. Imagine how amazing it will be in the future if we had an ability to say, oh, I'm buying this IoT device, and on it it says it's capable and usable and secure on a .ca domain. In a sense, having each IoT device be given a micro domain that is registered by an entity that is trusted, that is knowledgeable, and that has the infrastructure, because it's a part of the stack of making all of these related organizations work together to create that registration and security. So they are also, and they are the ones who are going to be demonstrating the ability to migrate or move a service commitment from service A to service B. They're going to use, we believe, this application using Access Security, where you've signed in with Access Security's provider A and chose to move your security facility to B on an IoT device. Today you have no choice. You stay with A all the time because that's where you bought your product. In the future, and they'll demonstrate their big capability, you could say, oh, well, I'm now choosing to go to B, move it, and in the B environment, you are now as secure, as capable as you were before. So those are the four applications, and they're going to get it done in 4 months, we hope.
Well, you have a track record of achieving these goals, but it sounds alarming to be four-month projects to, you know, show your prototypes and get it to a good place. A lot of what we're talking about makes me think about the need for standards in a lot of this IoT world. So as you're, you know, it sounds like you're building platforms and security products that will act as a sort of standard protocol to allow for different manufacturers to pick up and where things got left off and have the marketplace interact on the same page. Do you think about standards and, you know?
So totally. So we are not working independently. This, we are, so again, let's look at it to the overall. The three companies we're talking about are not itsy bitsy little companies.
Yeah.
These are all world-class companies. They have people in the standard bodies that are looking and addressing this thing. What we are doing with these companies in our accelerator is giving them a capability to test and engage with real users of this amazing technology that has been put together and change it if it doesn't work, or shift it, or adjust, and hopefully in the future influence the standard bodies, because even the standard bodies need the same kind of validation. The theory works. We know the theory works because in lab it has been proven to work. The question is, can we put it into reality? And we are one vehicle to show the world that we can do it in real implementations. And hopefully, at the same time, we can show the world that made in Canada is world class. All three companies are Canadian companies. All four selected companies are Canadian companies. And together, this is a made in Canada application that is going to be world class.
It's amazing stuff, Leo. I appreciate you giving me a lot of details into the projects and companies within your various accelerators. To go back to the top of your three accelerators, we talked about the LSpark sort of business SaaS accelerator, the original. How does the application process differ for the business accelerator to the sort of technical project base? Are you more headhunting for projects and you're looking for specific talent for the technical ones, if I can call it that?
The SaaS Accelerator is an accelerator that is open to all Canadian companies, and we are looking to get the top entrepreneurs, the top companies that are going to be the next billion-dollar companies in the future. That's kind of our hope.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the corporate accelerators, we actually have specific targets that the corporates have identified, not by name, but by segment. And therefore, our approach is much more hands-on. In the SaaS Accelerator, we may look at multiple hundreds of companies for each application section, and select eight. In a corporate accelerator, we are probably in a few hundred at most, because they are much more specific and much more narrow. In addition to that, the corporate accelerators require work. The companies actually have to not only change and improve their businesses, but they actually have to dedicate resources to do product development and engagement with the market that they did not expect to do before they joined the accelerator. So they have to be more mature. They have to have more resources. It cannot be a small team that is fully dedicated on path A, because now they have to try to do a path B. They'll have to be large enough to allow them to continue doing what they normally do and then enhance that through the corporate accelerator activities. They are usually a bit later stage companies.
And so these companies, say in the Secure IoT Accelerator, they would be allocating some resources of their business to work on these projects, or is it the entire company is pivoting to fit into?
No, so in all of these cases, these are not pivoted opportunities. They are, the way we've selected them is to say, these are companies that would want to do.
They're already on the path.
They are on the path, but it is somewhere, it's going to be 2 years from now, when the standards are going to be available, when I can buy something at this point and it's cost effective, when.
Yeah.
What we are doing for them is giving them very, very, very early access to an amazing technology, so that the when happens, they are actually at the market, and giving them a huge advantage, differentiated capability in that market, we hope.
We talked about the concept of containers in a really busy port, and I love that industry. It's really complex, moving goods around the world. Part of my thinking when we were speaking about that was the need for artificial intelligence to monitor all those cameras and containers. What is your view of the current state of AI, and is that just a rabbit hole to go down?
So AI is AI. You know, I joke around that, I'd love to have real eyes. Real intelligence is probably better than artificial intelligence, but that's just a joke. It's really, I don't mean that. What we are really doing in this area that has been now called AI is allowing the more efficient and more experience-based use of data. We've always known that data was valuable. In most cases, data was very specific. You use some data for a specific application to deliver the specific outcome. What we are now learning is that, in fact, a wide range of data, wide range of information can be used effectively to build efficient implementations in our business. So actually the use of new technologies called machine learning engines and those types of new developed technologies have reached a level of maturity where they can be accessed by the wide range of, I'll call it, general software practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they can now start to apply the mining of information that, in many cases, is already available inside companies to improve the efficiency and the operation of these companies. So I like the idea of applied AI, where we take these technologies that have been developed that allow you to extract higher value information from stuff that was already there and use that information to make decisions that improve the business. And I think that combination of analysis, recommendation, and decision is a key part of that. And therefore, I find it unusual to say I'm an AI company. Because unless you're in a tool business, you're not an AI company.
Yeah.
You are a container management company that's using AI in order to deliver a service in a much more efficient way, or in a much more desirable way, or much more user-friendly way. And that's the purpose I see of applying AI into the business. Now, research, real research, kind of primary research, is still required and still necessary, and there should be companies developing more and more tools, implementations, algorithms to allow that usage of data, mining of data, transformation of data into information as becoming a very useful tool. So that's how I see it. I think every company today, especially if they are in a software business, must have an AI part of their engine, because they need to be competitive, and everybody is going to make sure that as much of the information they have can be directed to improve their business. Whether it's simple as using your CRM to target your customer or building special purpose products that are providing higher value information to your customers, those are all part of that journey.
AI is a big topic. I like to think of it in the current state as very narrow in scope. You would use machine learning for something very specific, although it's more complex than the old computation. It's still a very narrow scope. I see some software companies moving forward, going into market without using any form of AI or even thinking about their strategy into the future. And it sometimes worries me that you would have a large investment into a software company and not, you know, start thinking and planning where you're going to implement these, because perhaps adding that later might be a bit of a challenge. It reminds me of a UX process. If you've already designed your system and then you do a UX process, it's too late, right? So maybe there's always time to add some sprinkles of AI into your product.
Well, I think we normally, everybody's using some form of data analysis, BI, the business analysis tools that have been in the past used, they are in early stage of what AI used to be. What we are now experiencing is more and more sophisticated, more and more challenging and improved ways of getting that information analyzed, improved, and delivering recommendations and ideally decisions that improve the business.
There's some underlying conversation we haven't gotten into is the entrepreneurship. I mean, you're very entrepreneurial by moving your career through military to your venture capitalist for some time, into very senior leadership and board positions. As you see entrepreneurship evolving throughout your career and the sort of state of entrepreneurship, you know, where are we at today?
So I think entrepreneurship is a lifestyle. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of living. It's a way of experiencing the world. Entrepreneurship deals with managing your goals, striving towards achieving your goals, thinking about your dreams and figuring out how you can achieve those dreams. So it is not a business activity. It is lifestyle. It's a way of growing and becoming a person that is living in our world. In a more narrow sense, in a business sense, entrepreneurship says I will be using business tools to achieve my goals. A lot of my goals are related to business activities and business goals, and now you're taking all that energy, all that passion, all that commitment to a goal and putting it on a business goal. Building a large company, employing lots of people, helping third world countries get better lifestyles, arrangements. These are all business, I would call them business goals or social entrepreneurship goals that are driven by individuals who have a passion about something and want to achieve it. And so I believe that that's something that everybody should strive for. However, it is also true that entrepreneurship is not something that everybody should do. entrepreneurship requires a certain way of thinking, a certain type of personality, a certain comfort with amounts of risk. And therefore, in my view, because I'm a passionate individual on entrepreneurship, I think everybody should try it and then find out, do I like it? Maybe not. Then it's not for me, and move on and become a very successful individual, a very great person, but not necessarily an entrepreneur. Or this is amazing, this is really what I want to do, and I'm going to continue improving and learning how to do that, and then go on and become an entrepreneur. Being an entrepreneur doesn't mean that you have to be as chief executive officer or a vice president. It actually means taking charge of your life, taking charge of your destiny, and working hard towards implementing it.
Those are very nice words to hear. So as you kind of move up the system of scaling up your company, the ease of access is evolving, right?
Right.
What can you tell me about that sort of mid-range of going from prototype to entering the marketplace, which is a big jump, right?
Right. I would say it is, if you think about evolution of an idea into a company from a business point of view, the idea is a personal thing. It's what you think is interesting. You develop it, you learn what it is, you understand it, you become passionate about doing it. It will change the world in some way. And that's individual. And therefore, you are mostly under your own control. As you get more supporters or partners into sharing that idea, you start to now gain broader and broader buy into it, but you're still self-sufficient. Once that idea becomes large enough that you start to engage with the rest of the world and either start getting additional funding and to help you, that's a transition that changes the way you are, having changed you from something that you own and operate and think about and it's your dream to something that's more shared and expectations are different. And that is the area where there is high risk in that transition. In our way of thinking about entrepreneurship, we may be spending too much time in building the first part of it, the ideation, the initial project, building consensus and acceptance of that idea, which is very exciting. Then we may be getting into something where we get some support from somebody to move on to the next stage. What I find that we lack in our ecosystem today is getting to that next stage where you are now sharing your idea project into being an independent project that you run to being a company.
Yeah, you're sharing the risk.
You're sharing the risk, which is why you want to do it. Mm-hmm. But the consequence of that is you are now bringing other people into the game. And we have been not as good as we could be yet in getting that handover. It's not so much that there aren't others later on stage to help grow and grow businesses. What we have done poorly so far, I think, is creating that handover, saying, oh, I'm in a university and I'm working in some entrepreneurship environment. I've got my ideas, I've got my supporting group, my professors are helping me with the idea and so on. I'm building it, that's all working well, that's all great, I'm doing fine. And I am then moving on to my incubator nearby that it's connected to my university, and that incubator is providing me a broader range of networks and introductions to other people and partners, and I'm growing. And now I've got 6 or 7 people working in my company, and I've got some activities going on, I've got some potential customers I have to serve, and there's no handover. Mm-hmm. The entrepreneur is left now on his own to try to figure out how to get to that next stage, how to make that next stage happen. How do I get my next customer? And there is no smooth handover. They are kind of left for themselves till they get to the point where they are recognized as a major player. So kind of that gap is a very high risk gap. And in our environment, in many cases, the companies end up faltering during that because they are unable to bridge that gap efficiently. And in many ways, I guess, one of the reasons why LSPARC has been put in place, why we are passionate and want to make LSPARC as big as possible and as successful as possible, because we are hoping to address that gap from having been in the project business, having sold our products to our friends, acquaintances and family who have all bought it because they think it's a great idea and they like us, to actually starting to figure out how they sell it to their strangers. Mm-hmm. People who've never known us, but only know us through our product and are recognizing the product to be sufficiently and amazing to actually go and buy it. And that transition is difficult to achieve. And it is why we believe that the best way to achieve it is through mentorship of senior serial entrepreneurs who've gone through that transition and successfully gone to the other side. Mm-hmm. Because they know two things. One is the world will not end if you lose your next customer. There may be another one coming. And there is another side, and here's what it looks like. And therefore, let's figure out how we get there.
I can understand that, you know, at an idea stage, there's a lot of support out there and your family and friends. And, you know, that support diminishes as it becomes more advanced and there's just really supply and demand. There's less people out there at a later stage to help you with that overall. I look at someone like Tobias at Shopify, you know, his story of turning into a leader of a major multi-billion dollar corporation is an unbelievable self journey for someone like that, to be able to transition yourself from, you know, a developer to a leader to a global leader. I think that's incredible, and right. Perhaps not everyone's cut out for that. So what is actually missing in our society then on that later scale? Do we need more advanced, you know, support systems like LSPARC to continue to grow?
You know, it actually is an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. We need a much stronger, much broader, much more resilient ecosystem. The ecosystem means we need more mentors who are able and willing to mentor and are getting compensated for doing good mentorship and are getting that mentorship in place. We need more accessible financial services to allow the ideas to be translated into reality. That takes money, and therefore we need that access to be facilitated. Doesn't mean that it has to be thrown away, but it has to be shaped and sort to allow that transition to happen. And then we also need to be much more self-promoting. This is, people have said that many times, we are Canadian, and as such, we are humble. That's great. It's a good trait to be humble, but the world is highly competitive, and therefore, to be successful, you have to compete, which means you have to declare yourself to be a leader, and try to achieve that leadership position and fight for it. It's not going to be handed over.
Leo, I really appreciate you taking time and chatting with us. It's very inspirational. I'm proud to be following along with LSPARC, and I've seen the growth here. And, you know, we could probably talk for a very long time about that. So I think I would thank you for what you're doing to contribute to the Ottawa economy, the Canadian technology economy. Your efforts are not going unnoticed.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I really would just like to suggest we are in here to give a capability to get our best entrepreneurs the best possible success opportunity and make sure that it happens competitively and as quickly to the market. And so my statement to the world is, hey, entrepreneurs, come and get it. We are here, and we're looking forward to working with you.
Leo Lack, a pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure as well.